Thank you very much. Thank you, Susan. Thank you for being here. I remember being here once during the event in 1999. Somebody reminded me. We had a debate here. They called it the Battle of Seattle, didn't they? Yeah. Unfortunately, there weren't many other battles later on. I want to thank you all for being here and listening to something different that you may not have heard before. You know, when you've been working in Washington, D.C. all these years, you see certain trends. Trends go up, trends go down, and you begin to putting things together that ordinarily you wouldn't be if you're just there for a year or two. And what I've seen is, first of all, massive number of muckraking books coming out in this country, exposing almost everything. They expose the military-industrial complex. They expose big pharma. They expose the chemical industry, the coal industry. They expose the oil industry, the banks, the insurance companies. They're coming out so fast I can't even keep track of them. And the more that come out, the less effect there is on what they're trying to change. I'm not saying there's a causation. I'm just saying that the ground is not fertile. We don't have the people we had in Congress 35, 40 years ago. There's nobody who can compare with Senator Warren Magnuson on consumer legislation, for example. And we don't have the labor union strength that we had then. We don't have the ability to express our hope that the press will cover us on a day-to-day basis. The press has gone into Pulitzer Prize-winning features. They like to do a major feature themselves rather than cover citizen groups' struggles on Capitol Hill to get something through that relates to the subject of the feature. And when the legislators know that the press is not watching them the way Drew Pearson watched them and Martin Mintz of the Washington Post watched them, they don't feel the heat. They just have to write out one page one feature. And of course, we have a situation where public TV and public radio have become increasingly cautious. They raise money from corporations as well as small contributions. They're more frightened of reactionaries in Congress than they are of progressives, because reactionaries know how to turn the screws and have no compunction about it. We have also the massive learning process by corporations who have learned how to game systems, how to delay better than ever through their corporate law firms, how to fund both parties now. It used to be that labor would fund more of the Democrats and business the Republicans. Now the Democrats dial for the same commercial dollars. So although we live in a golden age of documentaries, that's another situation where we have great documentaries coming out. Look how many great documentaries came out on the Iraq criminal war of aggression in Iraq. Virtually nothing. Even members of Congress who deigned to watch them. Nothing. So what's happening to us? Why is it that one of the assumptions of a democratic society, that is, if people are informed, they will act accordingly? Why? What's going on here? We have access to more information. If we don't like what's in the Seattle papers, we just go on the computer, or we listen to Amy Goodman, or we read the Progressive Populist, or we go to any number of blogs. So there's no more excuse as to not having the news right away. Even if we don't like the U.S. news, we can log into foreign websites and programs. So what's happening to us? The first is disclosure does not have its own imperative. It's not enough. It doesn't come close to being enough. Becoming aware doesn't mean we're going to act. Being concerned doesn't mean we're going to be serious. Because when it comes down to it, is the following. Why are 535 men and women in Congress, senators and representatives, who put their shoes on every day the way you and I do, captives, for the most part, a majority of them, by 1,500 corporations who have no votes? They have money, but your senator and senators and representatives don't get there except for votes. Money they like because they can put ads on and try to intimidate their opponents and make themselves look good. But we're the only ones that have the votes. So why is this artificial entity called the giant corporation, why does it have this kind of influence? Because it has other kind of power. It has the power to plan our futures. And it is overwhelmingly planning our political future, our elections future, our environmental future, our genetic future, our commercialization of childhood future. It's planning, more than any other entity, our military future that I know of. A good deal of our foreign policy planning. It's planning our trade future, certainly, NAFTA, WTO. It's moving to plan our educational future. Corporatization of universities well underway. And look what they're doing at the elementary and high school level with commercially managed charter schools. Not charter schools, commercially managed charter schools with multiple choice tests that are not really the way to assess a child's intelligence, a child's multiple intelligence. There's no one definition. So what's happening to us? Well, first of all, human beings are capable of incredible self-deception. We all have to fight that. We're very vulnerable to myths, because some of them we want to believe. And just because they're fictional, why not keep believing them? And one of the myths is that we live in a democracy. What does it mean to live in a democracy? Well, it means a certain level of freedom and justice. Well, let's take Marcus Cicero's definition of freedom. Over 2,000 years ago, he defined freedom as participation in power. Have you ever heard a better definition? By that yardstick, how much freedom do you have? Here in Seattle, state of Washington, the great Northwest, the USA, how much freedom do we have in any way, directly or indirectly, influence Bush and Cheney in their criminal, military, and foreign policies? How much freedom do we have in shaping this grotesque tax system that taxes things first that we like, but doesn't tax things first that we don't like carbon tax, Wall Street derivative speculation, corporate crime, sodas, maybe. How much freedom do we have anything that matters that's beyond our household? Well, some of it's a little bit here and there. How much freedom did you have in deciding whether your stadiums are going to be built by tax money or not? Do you think Paul Allen had more freedom than all of you combined? He actually did something which no one I've ever heard do in the United States. He actually bought an election day. Can you imagine that? He told the legislature, don't worry, I'll pay for all the precinct expenses. Let's have an election day in June. And then he proceeded to pump the money in. And people here were pretty skeptical. You know, the polls always show people don't want tax-funded stadiums for the sports owner billionaires. We beat it in Connecticut when the Patriots cut a deal from Boston to come to Hartford for a $550 million stadium and another $50 million for a practice field. You know, it's like a dessert. And we got fairly good cooperation with the media, and we turned the tide. It was 3-1 for the stadium, and we turned it in 4 months. And I came up here do the same thing here. It was close. And there wasn't any press around. It was almost like Mississippi North. There was absolutely nobody, no TV, no radio, no newspapers at all. Just before the election, the referendum. Some of you may remember it. So Paul Allen had more freedom to participate in the power that led to that tax-funded stadium than all the people in Washington State combined. So what about justice? Well, you know, justice is the great work of human beings on earth, said Senator Daniel Webster many decades ago. And look at what we're up to now. And to have justice, you have to have expectation levels. If you don't raise your expectation levels for what we expect to come out of our government, what workers should have as their just desserts from a large GDP economy, modern economy, why should they give it to us? Why shouldn't they concentrate wealth in the top 1% and have that 1% have equal wealth to the bottom 95% of people? How's that for a ratio? Why shouldn't they have the CEOs be paid 400 to 500 times the entry-level wage in their business, like Walmart? When I was a kid, it was 12 to 13 times the CEOs paid. We didn't think they were underpaid then. Now it's over 400 times. The head of Walmart makes about $11,000 an hour, 8 hours a day. Before noon, before he takes his first lunch break on January 2, he's earned more than any one of a million Walmart workers over the entire year. So why should they give us the just fruits of our labors? Because why should they worry? So here's what we've got to do. The first step in a democracy is to spend time on it. If you don't spend time as a routine in showing up at city council meetings, voting for things you think are important, putting initiatives on the ballot, showing up in courts once in a while, showing up in marches and demonstrations, and so many of you here tonight know what I mean. You call people up who agree with you, and you beg them to show up. You tell them half a democracy is showing up, and they agree with you, and they have the same grievance and the same complaints, and they're too busy, and they're too preoccupied. And about a month later, you say, you know, you didn't show up that meeting. You didn't show up that march on something you're really concerned about because you were too busy. Could you please tell me what you were too busy with? You can't remember? What are we so preoccupied for that we don't have time for democracy? So the first thing is time. Any tyrant who thinks that there's a movement, a democratic movement in their country, all they have to do is ask one question. How much time are people spending on it? If they're into their private lives, if they're into their rationale, of their own futility, if they have 100 excuses for not showing up for things they really care about, why should the tyrant be concerned? Now look at Bush Cheney, two tyrannical draft dodgers that loved the Vietnam War but wanted others to die for it. They were in the White House, and they had a predetermination to invade Iraq with a few neoconservatives, most of whom we're draft dodgers too. How did we ever get a country that took us into a military invasion in violation of federal statutes, the Geneva Conventions, and the U.S. Constitution? It was never declared by the Congress. Led by draft dodgers. I mean, where is our red-blooded Americanism, if I may coin a phrase? You'd think they'd lose some credibility, wouldn't you? But they didn't have to worry about us, because all they did was start pounding the lies through the mass media, which rolled over, with few exceptions, about weapons of mass destruction being tied to Al-Qaeda, threatening their neighbors, threatening the U.S. with drone planes and so on, and being in connection with 9/11, Cheney pushed that along. The media rolled over. Well, how about our Democratic Party in Congress? They rolled over too. So he had two potential opponents rolling over. And this is before the soldiers started going over, when the country is silenced, of course. So who was left? There are about 300 former generals, retired generals, admirals, former heads of national security agencies, CIA, people from the Department of State, the Pentagon. They're all retired. They all worked under Republican or Democrat administrations. People like General Zinni, retired Marine specialist in the Middle East, Admiral Shanahan, former head of the Pacific Fleet, Bill Odom, four-star general and head of the National Security Agency, and on and on. They spoke out against the war in the 6 months beforehand, including Brent Scowcroft, who is the chief security advisor to the first George Bush, George W.'s father, and also Jim Baker, former Secretary of State, very close to George Bush's father. So they all spoke out. Some of them wrote op-eds in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. They would put out a statement. Some of them testified. And then they went back home. At the same time, we have a mega billionaire, George Soros, in New York City and Long Island. He had lived in Hungary under fascism and communism, and come here as a young man, very, very rich, makes $2 billion a year routinely. He's a brilliant financier. He spoke out against the war. He had writings against the war. He's very incisive. He has comparative historical experience. He knows the signs when the drums are being beaten. He spoke out against the war. He gave interviews against the war. There's one thing he didn't do. He didn't put $150 to $200 million behind those 300 retired military, diplomatic, and security people to get them on TV and radio and newspapers day after day. Repetition is important those 6 months. To expose the lies and falsehoods and deceptions of the Bush-Cheney regime. They would have informed the American people that the U.S. Army was against the war up to the four-star general level, but were muzzled. They would have been more likely to be invited to Congress. We would have had perhaps thorough congressional hearings, because Congress can't really resist people who are on the national media day after day. He didn't do that. I called him in that period and didn't get the call returned. He's hard to reach. But you know, I don't know anybody who made that connection, that potential connection. Justice requires money. Peace requires money. We know war requires money. But $150 to $200 million for George Soros was nothing. He just made $3.7 billion last year. Billion. And he didn't think of it. He didn't think of it because, brilliant as he is, incisive in knowing how to build democratic institutions as he is, the starter of the Open Society Institute, he didn't have that requisite imagination. And so it does start with imagination. And we have to keep repeating that word again and again, because if we don't imagine, we won't envision. If we don't envision, we won't raise our expectation levels as to what is possible and very, very achievable and overdue for our society and our country's impact on the world. We have the lowest expectation level of any people in the Western world. Let's face it. The lowest expectation level of any people in the Western world. After World War II, we were the Colossus, the USA. No number two. After World War II, Western Europe was devastated, cities blown up, impoverished, people walking with one leg, 50% unemployment, countryside destitute. They pulled themselves together, a little help from the Marshall Plan, and they demanded through their multi-party system and through their trade unions, they were stronger than here, and through their cooperatives, stronger than here. Here's what they demanded and got for all their people. We have none of that for all our people. 65 years later. They got demanded and got universal health insurance for everybody. Nobody dies today in Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, Italy, Austria, Sweden, Norway, Netherlands, because they don't have health insurance. In this country, 45,000 Americans die every year because they don't have health insurance to get treated or diagnosed. Harvard Medical School research paper, peer-reviewed, December 2009, Journal of Public Health. That's 800 a week. They demanded and got paid daycare, paid maternity leave, and paid family sick leave, including grandparents. For all the people, we have none of that. They built decent public transit. Do we have that? They gave students university tuition free. Do we have that? The minimum paid vacation, regardless of whether you're in a union or not, 4 weeks. 7 weeks in Sweden. Shall we go on? That's what I mean about expectation levels. And we're passing these sign-ups for those to stay in touch so we can work together. And if you'd like my weekly column, I can send that to you online. By the way, it's being passed around. So why did I write my first work of fiction? First of all, if I did it nonfiction, nobody would believe me. This came out, I did this in equivalent 9 months. But it reflected 40 years of indignation and frustration. I'm really tired of our society paralyzed, stuck in traffic, can't confront any problem that's documented 1,000 times, whether it's housing, hunger, poverty, whether it's public transit, whether it's cutting down that military budget to a decent size, whether it's going after corporate crime and the looting of trillions of dollars of pension money and mutual fund money. I mean, how long do we have to remain frustrated like this? There's a huge consensus in this country. Once you get down to the specifics and you're not in the abstract ideological world where people can control us so much more easily, when you come down to specifics, liberals and conservatives want clean food, they want safe pharmaceuticals, they want their cars recalled. I haven't met a conservative yet who says to Toyota, "Don't you dare recall my car and fix it." There's a consensus here. 81% of the Americans in a recent poll think America isn't going in the wrong direction. 75% believe that corporations have too much control over their lives. And 61% believe both major parties are failing. That's a pretty good consensus. And when the Green Party puts people on the ballot with an agenda, you look at that agenda, and most of it is a majoritarian agenda. And the Green Party ends up with a fraction of the vote. There's a two-party system. Is a tyranny. It's rigged from the Electoral College all the way to exclusion from debates. It's as if we ration debates. I wish we would ration some other things, but we don't ration. Why should we ration debates? And why should we have a debate commission that's created by the two parties so that they can keep off everyone who challenges them? and therefore you can't reach tens of millions of people. So let's not kid ourselves. This is not a democratic society. To the extent that we have civil rights and civil liberties, we're lunching off the past, increasingly the remote past. Increasingly, we're taking these bursts of human rights that were installed in constitutions and previous laws, and we're using them less and less, defending them less and less, allowing corporations to use them against us because they've been given equal constitutional rights with us. And so the process is atrophying. To what extent in the last 60 years have we remodeled, renewed, updated, and invigorated our democratic procedures? We're still using stuff that's 200 years ago. And we're letting the corporations use it against us. Since when did the tobacco company's commercial speech earn constitutional protection? Since when is tobacco industry's promotions trying to hook 12-year-olds into a lifetime of smoking with a 1 out of 3 chance of dying from it getting constitutional protection? That's what I mean by using it right against us. So I decided to write this book, and let me put the thesis of the book to you. Suppose someone said to you, there are 17 super rich Americans in their 70s, 80s, and 90s who are very upset and concerned about the downward drift of the nation in many ways. And they don't want to leave this country in this state. And they're willing to raise and contribute $15 billion and go to the grassroots of our country, every congressional district, every state, neighborhoods, communities, all kinds of service clubs, thousands of lecturers every day, 400 recruiters, a clean elections party, a people's chamber of commerce. They're willing to buy an entire sub-economy in order to put forward sustainable practices and combat the forthcoming counterattack by the corporate giants who get wind of what they're doing to turn the country around. How would you advise them? Someone said, here's what it is. 17 of them, you know quite a few of them. They're Warren Buffett, they're William Gates Sr., they're Ted Turner, they're Yoko Ono, they're Bill Cosby, Paul Newman, they're other people you may not know. There's Ross Perot, Joe Gemayel, Peter Lewis. Anyway, they're all very rich. They all have their Rolodex. They all have their circles. They all have experience on how business operates. They know the warts. They know the underbellies of these business giants. And they're ready to go. They want to do it in 1 year. 1 year, you say? Yes, 1 year. They want to have the power collision. They're going to want to have the people recover their sovereignty, recapture the Congress, have their own mass media, develop clean elections, install all kinds of worker, consumer, small taxpayer organizations, develop community economics, more credit unions, more community energy, community food, more community health clinics in order to become more self-reliant and undermine the power of the big drug companies and hospital companies and agribusiness companies and energy companies and so on. So you got a couple months to figure it out. How would you advise them to proceed? That's what I asked myself. 700 pages. The detail in this book is to show it can be done once you accept the premise of a tiny, 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 tiny number of older, enlightened, super rich people. None of them are angels. That's one reason why they were so effective. So on the ground. And they're willing to put $15 billion in and leave some behind for future years. And they're willing to basically say to all these grassroots institutions, all these achievements, see you later. It's yours now. You got no one to blame but yourself.